Welcome to Fuji Love. This is the show that is all about the Fujifilm X-Series and GFX cameras, but more importantly, it's about the photographers who love to use them. I'm Mark Sadowski, and this show is brought to you by Fuji Love Magazine. For the latest and greatest in all things Fujifilm X-Series and GFX, whether it's news, interviews, and so much more, head on over to fujilove.com. Subscribe today. And now, on with the show. Before we start this week's episode, I wanted to share an announcement. Starting on April 8th, Stephanie, the managing editor of Fuji Love Magazine, she is hosting an online workshop with the one and only Mr. Whisper, who you remember we've had on the show a little while ago. And he is an amazing street photographer, a Fujifilm X photographer, and a master of low-light street photography. This is a four-week community learning experience, and if you want to know more, follow the link in the description of this episode and take part. Again, you can find the link in the description of this episode, and yeah, have a great time. Finally, one more announcement. I relaunched my YouTube channel. It's called Filmish. It celebrates the love of digital photography with that traditional film feel. It's a perfect fit for Fujifilm photography and so much more. I'm really excited about it, and I have a couple videos up with more to come, and currently update every other week. So if you want to see more, check it out. It's not film, it's Filmish. My guest this week is Megan Lewis. Megan is just an absolutely amazing documentary photographer. She is an official Fujifilm X ambassador and an author and a therapist. And I am just absolutely wondering where you had time to do any of this, because that is quite the resume, because you've been featured in International Herald Tribune. While I'm not familiar with that publication or that newspaper, I am familiar with Time Magazine, where you had one of your photos on the cover, the Washington Post, and like just so much more. Good to have you on the show. I just love your work.
No, thank you, Mark. It's very generous of you.
Go on. I'm sorry.
No. You ask the questions.
So looking through your work. And I highly recommend everybody go to your website, meganlewis.com.au. Is that correct?
Yes.
Cool. The last thing I read is that you left the newspaper industry to live full time among the Mardu people. Is that still the case?
Is it still the case that I live with them? No, I don't live with them, but I did. This is a long time ago. So, yeah, in brief, I started out my career with Reuters International News Agency, which I think is now Thomson Reuters. And then I, after 4 years of being with them, that was in my 20s, long time ago now, in the 90s, I started working for News Limited, so the Murdoch papers, which was at that time the main broadsheet sheet paper. The national paper for Australia was called The Australian, and I moved from Sydney to Perth, and whilst I was there, I was lucky if I was home 2 days a week. So Perth is pretty isolated compared to the rest of Australia, but it's close to Asia and other places. So I was flying out, every week, mostly doing different, anything that came up that side of the country, I did. I also represented the Australian media and travelled with the Queen in 2000. And so I switched from doing that stuff to go up to Asia, into East Timor and Indonesia when the riots were on. And then we also, so Western Australia is a really vast state, And it's a lot of it is outback desert country. And we had at that time, that was back in the late 90s, Aboriginal communities that still, and they still do till this day, live very remotely out in these, out in the desert. And we, as a good news story for the Australian at the time, they decided there was a mining company up there, and the mining company were doing something with the young men playing football. That's Australian rules football. And the newspaper thought it would be a good idea to send us up there, a journalist and myself, to photograph them doing something positive. And it was, that was a turning point in my life, that one trip for flying up there for 2 hours out to the desert. And I found a real rapport with the mob, as they, we call them, the different sort of mob to your mob. They call themselves that, I should say. And from that moment on, I thought I needed to tell their story from the inside out. So in brief of that, I spent 2 years traveling 1,600 kilometres, driving up to the desert, any loo days that I got from the newspaper, and just building up a rapport. And after 2 years of doing that, I realised, because no one had ever, they'd never allowed anyone to photograph them before or live with them like that. So they said, yes, they agreed, we could do that. And I thought, I need to do a book because I need to show Australians and the rest of the world that we have more in common in an, than we don't. And it's the same for everything, I think. There's that universal connection.
Yeah.
And I thought the media misrepresented, because the media is only really interested in reporting on the negative. So I wanted to show, and anthropologists say what people do. I wanted to do a book about, and do a story about how people feel about what they do, not what they do, it's how they feel about what they do, and to document that. So I left my full-time job and packed my car up, left the boyfriend, and drove to the desert. And I thought for 6 months, but it ended up overall from start to go, it was an 8-year project. And wow. I lived with them for nearly full time for 3 years and then back and forth. So overall, book came out after 8 years. You haven't got a word in, have you? I'm giving you a whole summary.
No, that's okay. Is the book still available? Can people still purchase it?
It's out of print. I do have some copies left that I've kept, and I think that they can get it on I think on eBay or Amazon. There's some probably secondhand copies, but I do have some that are left. Yeah.
What's the name of the book so people can search for it?
So it's called Conversations with the Mob, and when it came out, it was released in 2008, and it's a coffee table book, but it's 25,000 words and about 111 images. But so it's sort of a coffee table book, but with a lot more substance and very in depth. Yeah.
And so I'm curious, if they were so, if this culture was very hesitant to bring outsiders in, what do you feel is the deciding factor to invite you to view their lifestyle, their heritage? Like, what do you feel is that deciding factor that made that connection so strong?
Trust, I think, because they saw the effort that I put in to spend the time with them. And I think they realized very early on that I wasn't there just to take, I wanted to show what was going on. And of course, it's you've got a lot of people, so everyone had different opinions, but the elders and the older people understood that their story needed to be told, and it needed to be told in a way that was comprehensive in the fact that the time was spent. Time is a big thing, and that you didn't just run, you didn't go in and then just run away when it got tough. So my whole life, I went in, I suppose when I went to live with them full time, was to not bring myself into the picture as you do in documentary. You're supposed to be, you know, on paper, you're the observer. You're not supposed to influence the story. But as soon as you as a human being walk into a space, you're already influencing it, whether you say something or not.
Right.
My my objective was to be as stay as present as I could and be as objective as I could. But of course, when I went in there, when you live there, you're part of the whole. You become part of the whole fabric.
Yeah,
and you become part of their world. And I have other abilities, obviously, outside of photography, and I've always had them. And I have they're very intuitive. They're very psychic. They have traditional healings, and I am able to do energy healing as well. It's something that I kept very quiet to myself during the media, except I photographed people that were traumatized, and I would be able to help them on other levels. Sometimes just being in the room, people would say, I don't know but what's happened, but I feel a bit different. And you quietly think, yes, I know why, but I'm not saying anything. But out there, it's very, very much cultural. And there was in a part of the fabric being that way. But they don't suspect that non-Indigenous people have the same abilities. I mean, at the end of the day, it's in every culture, but they weren't so aware of that. And there was an instance where one of the head, that you would call him universally a shaman, but he's in the Aboriginal community, in the Maru community, they're called Marban people.
Yep.
So he was a wise man and an absolutely beautiful man and a healer. His wife became very ill when we were out away from everybody, and I helped her with the energy. So I put the camera down and I helped her. And the next day, I had only been in the community about a month or so, I think, or maybe six weeks. And she came to me, everyone sort of stepped back, and someone said, Walker, that was her husband, he's passed away now, so he wants to see you. And I thought, everyone, oh, hush, hush. And I thought, oh, no, this is it. I'm going to get kicked out. You know, as a white woman that's done something that's men's business. Oh, dear, it's all over. But Walker wanted to see him, and he said, why didn't you tell me, berated me, why didn't you tell me, in his broken English, why didn't you tell me you had these abilities? Because we need somebody here. I need somebody to help support me in what I do. So that, in a way, opened the door into my world with them, and their world into my world. And then after another couple of months after that, two men went missing out into the desert, and they found the body of the first person. And I was saying, I need to photograph this, because in Australia everyone thinks, oh, well, if you're Aboriginal or you're Blackfella, they don't get lost. They go walk about, they don't get lost, they know where they are. And right. I thought, well, this again shows that we're all fallible. I mean, and this can happen to them, and it does happen a lot. They run out of water, their tires, the vehicles break down, and people perish. And the desert is very like getting in a dinghy in the ocean. You might think that waters are calm and it's all great, but it can change very quickly, and it can become a very life and death situation very quickly. And this is sort of what happened with them. It was a bit of a strange one, but they did find the first body. They had the SES, the police, they had everyone. They couldn't find the second person. So I ended up, the men and people like Walker said, no, she's got to come. They said they were remote. They were 5 hours from where we are.
Can I interrupt you for just one moment?
Sure.
Because what I want to implore our listeners is to keep an open mind, because some a lot of preconceived notions about energy healing and things like that. I just want the listeners to understand that different cultures, different upbringings. I mean, my Polish upbringing, I had a grandmother that was very akin to what you're describing. But what I wanted to ask real quick is, what is your training for the energy healing? Is it, I think it's Qigong or Reiki?
It came naturally to me. It was always just a natural thing. But, yes, I have trained in Qigong after that.
Thank you.
But, yes, it's all along the same things. And my father's Irish, so you talk about that culture. It was in my father's side as well. So, yes, and I'm aware that normally we wouldn't really speak about this, but if you're talking with Aboriginal cultures, it's very much imbued.
Yeah.
So that it's more relatable to the fact that if you a window into that, into their world, and the reason that they trusted me so much is because they understood really that I didn't make fun of that part of their culture, and they are very, very protective of that, because when early pioneers came and people who didn't misunderstood how they worked,
especially their
when the missionaries came and tried to disimbue them of that side of their culture, and when you think about it, they'd lived when all traditional cultures, when they lived for thousands of years without the Western medicine that we have now to heal, you really, really have to draw on the resources that you have. And so there's an innate understanding that you can work on different levels. And that's really what they had and have. And so and it was certainly not my intention, as I said before, to let on that I had any of those abilities. And it wasn't, you sort of got roped into it.
So I apologize for interrupting, but I need to know, was the second person found?
Yep. The men got me out there, and it's a bit like water divining, people who can water divine. I had the ability to find where this person was, and they had been looking for 2 weeks, and so it was all the men, all the traditional men were out there tracking, trying to track, and they'd lost the tracks, and I picked up where he was, and sadly he had passed away, but we found him. I found him within 2 hours of going out there, and which meant that it was an enormous closure for the family, because yes, as anybody who knows who's had someone missing, it's a very, very upsetting thing. And so we found him, and in that moment, it was a turning point for the men. It was a turning point for the whole community. All of a sudden, I wasn't just a white fella. I became a human being. And they understood then that I was really there to do the best I could to tell their story and to understand them on lots of, on a multi-dimensional level.
You were able to understood them better than anybody else that was there. I totally hear you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Because a lot of people, and, you know, anthropologists too, will write all about their belief patterns, and they don't, because they're coming from a scientific part, they don't really believe all the cultural stuff, all this metaphysical stuff, and they sort of write it how the mob will tell them about it, but they don't really understand it.
Right. And so, I'm going to assume, mind you, you being a therapist, you could say if I'm correct or incorrect, but even anybody with like any kind of psychology background will also, ascribe these to beliefs and thought patterns without understanding the true intention or how this governs or not governs, I should say, is interwoven into the fabric of their lives.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
How has this, so going in, you jumped from, you were in journalism, so I don't want to say well-paid job.
No, some do, and I hate to say it because definitely in the era where the men got doing the same job. Well, I shouldn't say same job. Maybe I was doing a lot more at times, and they were getting paid more. And I think, some people got paid well and some didn't.
When I was with my newspaper, this is back in the 90s. Even back then, newspapers were on like a tight budget. Reporters had to do the photography. There was just no money and everything. It's been a thing. You know, the circumstances may change, but the situation is always the same. But
yeah,
but what I'm getting at is you went from a very prestigious place and basically either I don't want to say give it up, but you suspended that. You put that aside to spend time with this this amazing culture.
Yeah.
What?
I gave it up. Yeah. Gave it up to go and do that. Yeah.
Was that like an instinctive thing or like what was
it? It was a gut feeling. I always made the major decisions in my life through gut feelings. And yeah, we'll jump back to when I was 16, I had a dream and I knew I had a dream that I was walking beside a tall black man and we were walking through a lot of rubbish lying around. And he was telling me his story. And he said, Can you tell that story? And I said, yes, but you got to give me some time. I'm only 16. I'll come later in my life. I woke up the next day and I thought, I grew up in New Zealand, so not Australia. I'm a New Zealander.
Yes.
And across, as we say, across the ditch.
but what a lovely ditch it is.
Yes, that's right. Very different looking. But yeah, so when I met the mob that first time when I was sent up there with a newspaper, I had a gut feeling I needed to tell the story. And so it all, when I actually gave notice to the newspaper that I was going up to do it, I was thinking, oh, my God, what am I doing? Am I doing the right thing? Because you think you've got your foot in, even if you're known in the industry, your foot's in the door, you're still taking it out. I'm taking a massive risk. I was leaving house, leaving income, leaving everything to do something on a gut feeling, or something that I felt I had to do. And funny enough, the manager for News Limited at the time said, oh, don't put your resignation in. What do you want? Do you want to go to New York? Where do you want to go? Don't do that, because they sort of been grooming me to become a picture editor. And I thought, oh, I don't want to sit behind a desk. I want to go there. But he thought he would entice me to stay by offering me up these other stints before I went. And I thought, no, stick to my guns, because this is, yes, if they'd offered that a while ago, yes, I possibly could. But, you know, in hindsight, I did absolutely the right thing. Financially, disastrous. But on a human level, just, you know, it changed my life, and I know it changed a lot of people's lives. And it was absolutely the right thing to do. And it didn't mean to say it was easy when I first went out there. I mean, I roughed it. I lived in the back of my car. I slept on the ground in the dirt. I didn't know where I was sleeping from one day to the next. And after a couple of months, I was thinking, oh, my God, what am I doing here? I mean, they're not easy people either. No, nobody's easy. And I was thinking, why? And I literally had one of those moments where I'd been camping out in 40-plus degrees heat in the dirt, in the dust, in the wind, in a swag, on a football oval, for 10 days, and the mob saying, because they're an opportunist culture, it's like, you, what can you do for me? What can you give me? And individuals with that. And I was thinking, oh no, I can't take this. I literally went a little bit troppo, got in the car, drove out, sat on my undies on the red earth going, what am I doing? They're pushing every single button in me. And then I realized they're just being them. It's only my thinking that is causing the suffering here. And I need to put boundaries up. I need to change stuff. And I need to take a different look at this. So I drove back in, and that's exactly what I did. And that was pre-finding that person that was missing in the desert. So they were pushing me then. They were really pushing me. I just, you know, a white fella type attitude. Well, so it was just part of the journey. But I also realized when you're in the media, well, back in the day, and you're obviously similar era, it's obviously everything's shifting now with journalism. But back in that day, like, I would fly into a rough place, like, where people, you know, into East Timor and things like that, where it was dangerous and people are getting, you know, your life is at risk on the job. But you fly in and you fly out. You fly in, you're there maybe 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks. But you're not responsible when you leave. You get what the editors want, you get the story, and then it's only always a superficial thing and you get to leave. In this job, I was there to do an in-depth and comprehensive understanding and reportage, if you like, which turned into more than that, of the layers of these people. And in that, then I had this enormous sense of responsibility to get things right. And the big thing was I realized that when you think you know something, you absolutely know nothing. As soon as you realize you know nothing, you start to learn something. And it took me 6 months of living with them to get the first really real picture, because they were so shy with all of that and they didn't want to be photographed in their houses. And they were also very, very aware of the criticism from the outside. Oh, they're living in rubbish. They're living in filth. I wasn't focusing on that. I was focusing on what was in the heart, in their person, in their personality. That's what I was looking for. Because for me, the understanding is it's universal in all of us. Our cultural conditionings mean that what we strive for is slightly different, but the fact that we strive for understanding, we strive to be accepted, and we want to find fulfillment in life. And that's the same whoever you are, wherever you are.
And
I guess that's what I was focusing on.
Yeah. And when your time with the people was completed, what was how long did it take you to make the book?
Well, I have to laugh, because when you go in with the mob, I don't know if you know lyrics from the Eagles, Hotel California, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. that's more appropriate. You never leave. I'm still on they're still in my life on the phone every week. And I have been out there and done so much more. But yes, in total, from the time that I actually first met the mob and from the beginning of going back and forth and until I lived there and then to put the book together was 8 years.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
Especially in Australia and worldwide, I'm curious.
Sorry, I missed the first bit.
How was the book received in your country and worldwide?
In Australia, it was huge, because there was nothing ever like that. Nothing had ever been done in that way and in that depth that covered all aspects of their life. So I think the exhibition was just in the opening of it in Fremantle, 500 people turned up. Just for the opening, they couldn't fit in the building. And then I was on all the TV and back-to-back radio station, I think, in a few days. I'd done about 12 radio interviews and then writers' festivals. Yeah. And it was a huge, I felt enormous sense of responsibility to get things right. And I didn't feel that the book was mine. I felt that the book, I was the person who created the book, but it didn't feel like my book. It felt like it was everybody's story.
Yes.
And it was almost something I felt like it was contracted in my life to do. That's how it felt. Yeah. But overseas, I had an exhibition in Austria the year later, and yeah, same thing, people were fascinated by it because they didn't get, it was like being able to have a window into a culture that people didn't really know about because it had been fiercely protected by the mob. Yeah. So, yes, I think, and we did.
How has the mob been received by the Australian community? Has there been any positive changes in how like maybe legislation is being formed, or
it's such so complicated. I think it was more on that level, those ongoing, and there's ongoing issues. There's always issues out in the communities. And sadly, there's been a lot of tragedies with people passing away. Those same things happen. But there has been, particularly out in that group, there's been people that have come out and done a lot more things with them that they probably wouldn't have done before. So there's a lot of positives. There's still issues that are, the drug and alcohol problems are still a big thing.
Yeah.
We've lost diet. Whilst I did the book, I really was a firm believer in getting people an understanding about a high sugar content and diet way before, like 20 years before it became a popular thing. Because so when the book was released, published, I went back out to the desert and I set up I got asked by the elders in a community that was on the edge of the desert. And this was a community that is called Warralong, which was, they're related to the Madu, but they're a different language group. But the elders had heard what I'd done out in the desert. And that was including helping you on a therapeutic level with, I worked with a lot of the young ones, and I worked with a lot of the young men and people that were, suicidal as well. And this community, particular community, had 60 to 70 children, which were a lot of them virtual orphans. They were cared for by their elders and some young families, but mostly pretty dysfunctional. They had a school and they had a brand new principal who wasn't very at that time experienced with our remote communities. So the mob had said, can you please come and do what you've done with the Madu, come and do it with us. So I ended up coming and working in the school, and I set up a healthy eating program, and I got the children off sugar, and I got them off mostly wheat and off dairy. So within a couple of weeks, all the mucus and issues that they had with their ears and their noses cleared up. And within 5 weeks, the teachers were actually able to teach the children instead of them literally running up the wall and all over the place.
Yeah.
Because they weren't high on sugar. and so I would sit in class and watch and the teachers would say, this one, we think this one's had problems, emotional problems. Can you work with these children? So I'd work with them and with a group or with an elder. And then I set up to get them really enthused about the food. So I was cooking the food as well. So I was working crazy hours doing food, doing therapy and doing photography with them. So Fuji donated some cameras, and I thought, to get them interested in their food and photography, we started doing cooking lessons, and they would start to, each class had to come up with recipes with healthy stuff. Then they had to do their photography and photograph the food. So we taught them food photography. Then it developed from there into shooting music videos. So we made music videos as well. And one of the music videos, one of the young men in the community was singing by himself. And I said, right, look, I'm not musically minded, but I can tell a story. Obviously, I can tell an emotional story with a music clip.
Yeah.
So we got the whole community on board. 200 people turned up for the shoot. And we got him singing, and we got the others. They could pick up the music. We got the rest of the others to become part of the band. And so it happened at the time there was a guy that actually recorded music, was out there, and we pulled it all together in a week and got him to record the music, got them singing in their language in the chorus. We went out and shot it on different locations, and we got one of the young men in the community, one of the girls, to act out the lyrics, and that was about drinking too much and going to jail. We got the police on board. The police came and made false arrests and stuck them in the old lockup, and we turned it all, a whole production in a week.
Holy crap. Why is Fujifilm released that footage?
Well, it's out there. It is. I think it's on one of the community websites now. But it was a huge achievement because it got them on the creative side. Of course, we did the still photography from the shoot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're singing off key on some parts of it. But out there, if anyone knows what the mob are like, to try and organize anything is this the hardest thing? Yeah, I'll be there. They don't turn up. Yeah, I'll be there. Well, yep. We managed to pull it off. And the fact is that the two people that I wanted to be the lead in it, the male and female, to be acting out the part. Now, the young guy, he's really, really good. He's in his 20s. But in the community, you're never allowed to think that you're better than somebody else, or that's shame. That's what they call shame.
Yeah.
And so he says, oh, no, they're all going to give me a hard time for thinking I'm better, you know, putting myself forward. And I said, well, I've got a plan. And I will use the psychology here. And the other young woman, she's beautiful as well. And I said, I wanted her in it. And I said to him, well, I'll walk down the community in the night, in the evening. Everyone's sitting around, they're cooking on their fires. And I'm going to ask you, just leave it to me. And because they're all saying, oh, yeah, who's he think he is? He thinks he's too smart to be in that video. Why does he think he's better than everyone else? And so I walked down the community about 6:30 at night, and I knocked on his door, and he came to the door, and I said, oh, he says, yeah. And I said in a really loud voice, everyone's looking at, what's she doing? What's she going to talk to him about? They're all, their ears are flapping big time, all the women sitting there and the other men. And I said, oh, you know, this music video, where I really, really want you to be the lead, and I know you don't want to do it. He says, nah, I can't do it. And I said, but I really want you to do it. Who are we going to get to do it? And all women are listening. Next thing they go, oh, you got to do that. You got to be in that video. You know, hey, you're stupid. You got to do that. Yeah. And so that's how we did it. So he got the approval by the mob to do it by saying he wouldn't do it. That's how you got to work the culture, sometimes backwards to go forward. So because they supported it.
Well done.
Yeah, that's how they all turned up and supported. So it's good. Yeah. That's part of understanding how the culture works, understanding how, yeah.
That is so fascinating. So what are you doing now?
Oh, what am I doing now? Oh, well, it's photography. I haven't got a project on at the moment. I do a lot of the bread and butter stuff, working on feature films or TV series. The last half of last year, I was flying back and forth from New South Wales, which for people who don't know, just south of Sydney. Sydney's in New South Wales, but I live just south of Sydney, flying back and forth to Perth, which is a 5-hour trip, to work on a TV series with a well-known Australian cook, or she calls herself a cook. Some would say a chef, but she calls herself a cook. She's one of Australia's icons, so Maggie Beer. So I've been working on a TV series with shooting the stills on that.
At the moment I do
lots of things. Photography's certainly been a major part of my life, but I did stupidly be pre-COVID, I should say, not stupidly, but I had been working on setting up photo workshops that are also therapeutic out in the desert with my Māori friends. And so it would have been a cultural experience, as well as going out photographing amazing scenery out there, and as well as being as mindful, having been able to just come back to nature, breathe, and also learning about the Māori culture. And that was 2019, but I was planning all of that, and I had to get a food van in order to be able to have the proper kitchen out there in Australian requirements for health and safety. Yep. And we all know what happened then, COVID.
Yeah, so, that was easy time for you guys, right?
yeah. So we all had
some of the craziest lockdown that I heard in the States. Like, you guys really...
madness.
Multiple locks.
Oh yeah, unreal. Yeah, unreal. So that sort of shut everything down. And if you weren't in WA at the time, they sort of kept that freer, but you couldn't get there. It's like trying to get to Mars.
Yeah.
So we had to put it all aside, and so here I was with, and I had major health issues. So in a way, funny enough, if I had gone out there, I might have died, because I did have a major health issue. Funny enough, I after in between the lockdowns, I was working on another TV series with that was about end of 2020, I think it was. Yeah, I don't know if you're in the States, you know, have heard of Dr. Michael Mosley. Trust me, I'm a doctor. He's a UK TV presenter, medical doctor. He's the little one who's promoted fasting and about diabetes. And anyway, he was in Australia shooting a TV series, and I was doing the stills on that. And we were outside our Parliament House in Canberra, and they were testing politicians for type 2 diabetes.
Wow.
Here I am waffling.
It's all good. I mean, it's all fascinating. I have heard of him. I got to be honest. My knowledge of Australian TV kind of revolves around the comedy group Auntie Donna. And so anything that I see in between that, it sticks.
Yeah. Well, he does most of his stuff for the BBC. So, and he's shot quite a bit in America as well. But anyway, he was here doing a production, and how photography. See, photography, I always say it's an incredible vehicle. It's an incredible vehicle to open doors into other people's worlds and insights. Yeah. And for me to go to the desert, it changed my life. It changed the lasting friendships that I have with people there. But this time it actually saved my life, because they were testing, they had to put a gazebo up outside Parliament House. I had to, getting the politicians to come out to try and bring the awareness to type 2 diabetes and fatty liver. So they had a whiz-bang ultrasound on set. They had about five doctors, including an emergency doctor and a sonographer. And during the day, some of the crew were getting tested for type 2 diabetes and for fatty liver. And I had actually suspected I had something wrong with my health, but it was a sliding door moment. And I thought, while I'm working, I'd made sure when I'm shooting, if I'm shooting the talent, the main presenters, I try and get the pictures as quick as I can in the morning, even though we had scheduled the main hero shoot for them in the afternoon. I got some pretty strong images in the morning, and I always think if anything happens, I've got these images.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I did, and my intuition had said that, to do that. At lunchtime, or about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I was thinking, should I get tested? Should I not? The producer, who is a friend of mine in Perth, she had said, oh, the crew, she intuitively said, something came into her mind, said, oh, the crew can get tested today. And I thought, no, when I'm working, I don't mix that sort of stuff. I'm here on the job to be professional, do this. And then I thought, sliding, maybe I should get tested. Maybe I shouldn't. I literally rocked from one foot to the other. And Julie, who was the sonographer with the ultrasound, I thought, she's working. I don't want to ask her. And I looked at her. I thought, she isn't doing anything at the moment. And this feeling just said, no, get it done. So she put me on the table just behind a screen and under a gazebo, and started to put the ultrasound where my liver was. And then she's taking a bit longer. She said, can you just move your top up a bit? And I'm like, yeah, all right, yeah. And then she got me off the table, and I'm thinking, she's found something. She's found something. She got me off the table, and she just started to ask me, a bit like I was a kindergarten child, preschool, well, what's your full name? My full name's this. And she asked me those silly questions. What's my fatty liver like? And then I said at the end of it, I said, well, what's my fatty liver reading? Oh, she said, oh, you're really low. So I went, oh, yeah, thanks. Walked off to the green room tent, saw one of the soundos, and he said, oh, what'd you get? And I said, I got a really low fatty liver one. Next thing, Julie came over with the emergency doctor that was volunteering on set, and he just said in a stern voice, he said, Megan, can we have a quiet word with you? And I thought, suddenly went into a child mode. What have I done wrong? Have I done something wrong? He said, Julie's just found something very disturbing. He wants you to put your camera gear down now. And I said, why? He said, well, it looks like you had a 15-centimetre blood clot that's running from your navel, right in your IVC main vein into your heart, and it's flagging, and it can drop, break at any moment. Basically, he was trying to mop the beads of sweat from me and look very calm. And and not try on to let on to me how critical that was. And I said, well, I don't think the producer's going to be happy about this. Oh, I said, you sure she'll understand? I said, I don't think she'll understand. We've got the rest of the shoot. And I said, oh, I might need to finish that. And he's like, no, I don't think so. And he said, get back on the table. I want to have a look for myself. And he said, no, I just don't move. Don't move. We're taking you straight to emergency. So there you go. Wow. Photography can ended up, yes, I went to emergency. I was there. They decided they wouldn't operate because it would probably kill me. It was 8 days in the hospital, thought my body might be full of cancer. And anyway, sent me home, didn't find any, sent me home with heavy duty blood thinners, wasn't allowed to lift, move, couldn't do photography, couldn't lift the camera up for 9 months. And then they thought it was reducing and they found out that I ended up having to go and have an operation right through the middle of COVID. I actually shot a Fuji video. If you see it online, it was it's one with the Mogo Zoo. I was literally waiting for the call of a surgeon. I had to have and trying not to drop dead on the shoot when I was promoting one of the Fuji cameras because they were waiting to take me straight into hospital. But I said I'd do the shoot.
Wow.
So I ended up having to be put in a deep hypothermic state, 18 degrees, and put into the near-death state and get opened up from my throat down to my groin. And they found a 40-centimeter tumor that had gone from inside my main vein, wrapped through my heart and into my lungs. So yes, my photography got put on hold. And yeah, and I think like a lot of people who have been through stuff with COVID, I came out of hospital 3 weeks and my father died. And then one of my very close friends, the Māori, passed away, Walker, who was the healer. And I had a food van.
Wow.
So that's a long-winded way of saying, what are you doing now? Well, I ended up putting the food van down at a caravan park. If you're not doing photography in life, if you can't do what you do something that helps.
Yes.
And so we turned the van into kind of like serving people coffees. And I thought everyone who comes to the van, I pay attention to them and pay attention to what they're going through. So post COVID, it was a big thing. For people, a lot of people were traumatized. And
take the cake with that one, though. I think somebody should have given you some coffee right after all that.
You've just got to do what you can do, what's in front of you. And the irony of that is that we brought the van back from, and my mother got diagnosed. I had to have another operation 5 months after that one, and then my mother got diagnosed with, probably the shock of losing my father, got diagnosed with breast cancer. And I thought, we brought her lawn, her front lawn, this is a cul-de-sac, I can send you the video of this too, it's in a small coastal town.
Yeah.
And her cul-de-sac is a lot of older people. Now, and so I brought the van back. The only flat place I could park it was on her front lawn. We're still at the same time talking to the mob out there going, yeah, when we can, we're going to try and set up, we want to do these photo workshops and therapy, mindfulness stuff out in the desert, cultural. But in the meantime, I need to keep an eye on my mother. So I parked the van on her lawn. And then I said, well, there's a lot of lonely people here. I'll start giving them coffees. And one of the neighbors said, why don't you open it up here? So I rang the council, said, is that okay? Yeah, it's on private land. You've got all the health safety stuff. Yep. So we asked all the neighbors, do you want this? Yes. So all these people, we didn't know each other. It turned into this institution on my mother's lawn.
It's wow. This
coffee on my mother's lawn. All the coffee tables, they come and sit in the driveway on the coffee tables under the umbrellas, and now they're all friends. And we've got people from, we had children, people coming from children from 3 years to 97. And if they can't get out of the car, they drive up, help them get out of the car, they sit down, have coffee, and they've got friends. And now the ones who can drive end up taking each other to the hospital if they need to. And I try and give them healthy food. And, but yeah, so I do have a video of that. I haven't put it out on YouTube, but I can give you a copy to download so you can see what it's like. But it's something that needs to be everywhere. It's just, and then people coming in from Sydney, people coming in from Melbourne, they say, is this for real? Is this for real? And I go, yeah, it's for real. When it's raining, they sit in the garage on a sofa, Kiwi style.
This is amazing.
But it's really good coffee.
Yeah, I went to my wife. Wow, is this real?
This is real. Yeah, it's real. It's real. So, you know, if life, you can't do one thing, you do something else. So.
You not only took lemons and made it into lemonade, you turned it into a delicious cocktail that is like 5 stars on a menu.
Yeah, well, you know, it's all about the love, isn't it? It's sharing the love. As I say, as a photographer, you know, you know yourself. When you're photographing people, it's not about the photography, really. It's about the connection. You're really, in my book, you know, the work I do, I photograph the connection. There's people that are incredibly artistic and technically brilliant with their photography, and you can see that. But if you don't have the connection to the subject or the person or the animal, whatever it is, or nature, then if you don't feel connected to it, other people aren't going to feel so connected to your images.
Right.
And it's the same. It shows. You can feel it. You can feel it. And it's the same. Just, I mean, I've never done, oh, God, I do. I'm a barista now. Could you believe? I can't believe that. I was just too much on the creative side. I'm not clever like that. Now I do coffees. I think people who do coffees are really good. Now I do coffees. And it's the same thing. When you make a good coffee and you make somebody happy, or you do something good, it's all the same thing.
You'll be that is status.
yeah. But you know, it wasn't an easy journey. It hasn't been an easy journey, and unfortunately, my mother is renting this place, and she has to leave it now. So that is going to be the van's going to be packed up. But you know, we don't. I hope when we'll put the YouTube video out, we'll put the video out that it might inspire others to do the same thing.
Absolutely, that is wonderful. That is an amazing story, and I gotta say, I could. My God, I could just keep going on and on with your stories, because they are all fascinating. But as we wrap things up, I just wanted to touch on real quick the cameras that you're using with your Fujifilm journey.
Mm-hmm. So,
by the way, we will have a part two. I absolutely bring you back, because your stories are incredible.
Oh, no. No, I think most people have got amazing stories. They just don't think that they have.
Says the person who fought life and death and helped change everybody's life.
No. But so I use, I mean, obviously the X-Pro 3, and I love that. And the Fuji cameras always, because those cameras are so unobtrusive. They're beautiful. But when I'm shooting stills on a feature film or a TV series, I'm using the GFX 100S. I know there's been superseded now, but they're just such incredible files. They're beautiful. And the fact that you're basically shooting a medium, or they call it large format camera, that can shoot like a 35mm in the speed, and it's just incredible, really. So, yeah, I chop and change, but I think if you look at the Fuji videos, I've used the X-T5, and that's, you know, the fact is, it doesn't really matter what the Fuji camera you're using. They're small and the quality is incredible. It's what feels appropriate for you and what you're shooting with, what you want to shoot with. You know, I also, for Fujifilm, I started back in 2013, I think it was, shooting that when I got asked by Fujifilm to shoot a promo video. And I thought, and at that stage they were pretty much just sticking someone in front of a camera and pretty much a selfie and talking about all the technical stuff. And I thought, well, no, I can't do that. It seems false to me. I do documentary. I'm a documentary photographer. I tell stories.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to use the camera, I'm going to, if we're going to have the resources to do that, I'm going to tell good stories. So the first one was probably a bit long-winded, but it was me. In between all of this time, I did end up taking two children on from the desert, whose mother who had mental health issues, and I ended up taking them on and looking after them for 2 years as well. And there is the first Fuji film is the story of me finding the children after 6 years of, I had them when they were 4 and 5, and then I lost touch, and I used the opportunity of doing the Fuji promo video to find the children. 2 weeks after that, the children ended up in my care. But it was the start of the Fuji film. So if you, that is the other thing. There's ones with Jack Piccone, who's an incredible Australian documentary photographer who's based in Asia. Jack is extraordinary. He's done all the wars. And he's a deeply thinking person, an incredibly intelligent and emotionally intelligent person. We shot with the X-T4 shooting video with him. We shot that in Nepal. I focused on post-traumatic stress with that. So we did another one on the X-T5 where I'm living down in Aladala on the marine emergency people here who are mostly Australian waters. Your people that are keeping you safe are retirees. So we did it on the older people and how important they are. So every story, and there's Russ Ward who shoots with a GFX and does the big surf wave ones. We did ones on him as well. There's quite a few. So all different cameras, but they're all, it's anybody's choice to go out and it's how you connect and what you photograph.
Totally.
And how you photograph them.
That is awesome. So we're going to put the pin right here because there's still so much.
You got to shut me up. That's the problem. Feel free.
I mean, it's all fascinating. We didn't even go into origin stories. That's going to be for part two. In the meantime, Megan, tell the world where they can find you on the web.
Just my website, meganlewis.com.au. I'm also putting up a therapy website as well, since it's all interconnected. And I'm not a great social media person. I am on Instagram. I don't post a lot. Pretty bad. Do need to get better at that. Very much need to improve. But yeah, if anyone wants to contact me, ask me questions, you're welcome.
Awesome. Well, so awesome to have you on the show, and we will get in touch soon in a couple of months, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope to see you back next week. I wanted to also mention one more time that this is brought to you by Fuji Love Magazine. For the latest and greatest in all things Fujifilm X-Series and GFX, head on over to fujilove.com. Subscribe today. And my name is Mark Sadowski. You can find me on Instagram or Twitter, mostly Instagram though. I'm at Mark Sadowski. That's Mark with a C. And you can also check out my other podcast, X-Mark. It's a Fujifilm-esque kind of show, where it's more spice of life and pretty infrequent. But if you want more of my voice, that's the place to check it out. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon.